Welcome to the Naked Podcaster. I'm so excited. Oh my gosh, I made a huge error, Bruce. I did not ask you how to pronounce your last name. Solheim?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes! I did it. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How about you, Jen?
I'm wonderful. I'm excited to have you here. I'm going to jump in, and one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to tag our friend Mickey Mickelson. Because he referred you to me, and I'm always so excited about that. Where are you calling in from?
I'm in Southern California, in Glendora, California.
Awesome. We're on the same time zone and everything. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought? Excellent. I have your website up, and it's your name. Well, it's Bruce Olav Solheim.com. We'll have that in all of the show notes. Let's jump in. I want to hear all about this. You are very interesting.
Well, thank you. I do the things that I feel compelled to do. And that's the direction I go. So whether it's comic books or writing plays or writing paranormal books or writing history or political science, or theater, you know, we have a live online theater company that we've been doing during the pandemic. So I got a lot of different projects going on. There's never a dull moment at our house in this creative area, my library, as I call it, in the house. And there's always something going on. I'm always busy. And so it depends on what day. Right now I'm working on a new paranormal book. So that'll be out in the summer, but I just released my second comic book, which is actually a graphic novel. It's a little bit longer than a comic book with my character Snark. So I'm just doing a lot of fun things and you know, this is the best part of my life, really. I'm 62. I'm 62 years old and I'm doing everything I've wanted to do. And when I look in the mirror in the morning, I look at a happy person. So
that's really pretty incredible. I want to go through, I love that you said you do the live online theater program. If there's somebody interested in that, what would they have to do? Can other people join? How does it work?
Well, it started, actually there's a paranormal beginning to it, which is kind of fun. So that's kind of spooky and fun. A dear friend of mine, Gene, who was an actor and a childhood friend, we grew up together. He had Norwegian immigrant parents as well in Seattle. And he passed away in September 2016. A month later, he came to me in a vision. And he's been talking to me ever since. And I take meditative, what I call spirit walks, every couple days. And I connect with those in the afterworld, and I am in constant contact with him when I do that. Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, he suggested to me during one of these spirit walks, you got to keep the actors going because the actors need to be with each other. They need to act. They need to do something. And all of the theaters were shut down, everything. And most of them still are.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay, let me get it started. And I put out a notice on Facebook to all my actor friends, because I've produced a couple of plays already. And they just responded. They just couldn't believe an opportunity. And now we've put out four what we call stream plays during the pandemic. In the last year, we put out four productions that have been live and online with remote actors all over the country, all working together. And the really unique thing about it, why we call it a stream play, is because my technical director, who's a technical genius, has been able to create a 3D virtual world for them to inhabit. So it's kind of like a video game. They have a green screen behind them, which I provided for them, and they inhabit this world that we've created for them. So we have more flexibility than an actual theater, a physical theater, because we can put them anywhere we want at much less expense. So for anybody who's interested, you know, send me a line and I'll get you in touch with our technical director, and he'll be more than happy to share what we've been doing in a more technical sense, or if it's just a general sense of how I got all these people to work together that, you know, they can talk to me about that. So it's been fun. And all the stream plays we've done have had like a theme behind it. I was compelled to do it. Like the first one was about school shootings and my experience, because I was in a lockdown with a potential shooter on campus in January of 2019. So I had written a play about that. One, it was about heavy topics, you know, but one was about suicide. And I have a friend of mine, Kevin Hines. I'm not sure if you heard of him. He's one of the few people who have survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And he's got this wonderful it's not a ministry, but it's not necessarily religious, but it's very spiritual in how he goes out and talks to people, especially young people, about suicide. And so I wrote a play about that. And we did a comedy Western because we felt like we had to go into a comedy realm. We've done these two heavy things. Let's go comedy. But even the comedy dealt with serious issues like racism and stuff like that in the old West. And the recent one is a really for children, and we're offering it to schools all across the country in lockdown. And it's about a refugee boy, an orphan who comes to East LA to live with his grandfather. And he has to learn how to get along with everybody, learn American culture. And his grandfather uses honeybees because his grandfather is a beekeeper, and teaches him about life using the honeybees as an example of how they work together and sacrifice and so forth. So that's the latest play that we've done. And so, yeah, it's anybody who's interested, I'll be more than happy to give them a push in the right direction to do. You know, there's no reason why we can't keep going. You know,
I love it.
Yeah. Oftentimes obstacles just provide new opportunities. So,
I mean, I found that to be the case. We're a year into the pandemic now, mm-hmm. as we're recording, and definitely there are pros and cons or negatives and positives to everything, but it has opened up opportunity to think outside the mm-hmm. box in a lot of ways. What a fantastic thing with the green screen, like a video game. That I completely got it as soon as you said it like that. I was like, oh, that makes total sense to me now. Yeah. Let's jump into some of your books. You have mm-hmm. several. You mentioned Snark already. That's the comic book. I'm going to go mm-hmm. to that page specifically. So Snark is a comic book, but it's more than that. So you have the second one that just released. Mm-hmm. Tell me about Snark.
Well, yeah. So Snark, the genesis of Snark, long story short, 1980, picture me in a prison guard tower. I was a guard, a military guard in West Germany in the army. And I used to take my drawing pad and writing pad with me, even though I wasn't allowed to do it, but I just have to write. I got to keep writing and drawing. So I came up with this idea for a character named Snark, who is an alien human hybrid. Well, I just played around with the idea, and then I got out of the military and went to engineering school in Butte, Montana, Montana Tech. And there, I needed some extra credit, so I signed up for a journalism class where I'd work on the school newspaper. And I told them, I have this idea for a comic strip. I'd like to do it. And they said, sure, go ahead. And so I came out with the first Snark comic strip in the school newspaper in January of 1982. I did five of them throughout that semester, and then I promptly flunked out of engineering school. So that was the end of Snark for the first phase anyway. And it just sat there in my mind, always thinking I wanted to do a comic book, but life got in the way, everything happens. And then I in January 2019, which is a very pivotal month there, my second eldest son who turned out to be an engineer, as fate has it, he designed a bust of Snark's head, and he gave it to me as a late Christmas present.
Wow.
And that inspired me to go back to Snark and go to my artist friend who I'd been working with, comic book artist Gary Dumb, who worked with Harvey P. Carr and American Splendor and had been a comic book artist since the 70s. I asked him if he wanted to work on this comic book with me, and he said yes. And a year later, we had our Snark One. That's the genesis of it. He's an alien hybrid character. He comes to Earth with this kind of horrible mission. He has to prepare Earth and humans for colonization. And when he gets here, he decides he really likes us because he is half human. So then he tries to help us and try to fend off the aliens that want to colonize us and somehow, you know, rescue us. And so that he has a series of adventures, goes, meets different people around the country and even up in Canada, you know, Northern Canada. And he has this sidekick with him, this cosmic staff, who's kind of a wise cracking comedy relief, you know, and he emulates the Rat Pack. So he talks like Sammy Davis Jr., you know, so he's kind of fun. And we find out his origin and Snark's origin in Snark 2. But that it combines humor and history, because I'm a historian, science fiction, fantasy, and we deal with social issues, but not in a pedantic way. You know, I don't preach to anybody. It's through the eyes of an innocent, an alien observing what's going on. And so that then exposes certain social issues like the border. You know, he has he looks at it, and his first remark when he sees the border in our southern border is, I wonder if this fence is made to keep people in or keep them out, because he doesn't know what's going on. So it brings up things for people to think about without hammering them, you know, trying to tell them how to think about it. So that's what I like. That's how I teach my history classes too. I don't preach to my, you know, make them force my students to have my opinion. I just expose them to the issues, and then I help guide them through their own formulation of an opinion and how to, you know, educated opinion about what's going on. And of course, working on solutions, because there's always the empowerment aspect to it. But yeah, so Snark, it's for all ages. I wanted it to be all ages. I didn't want it to be just, you know, like an adult comic, but it can be read by both at different levels. So you can read Snark as an adult and get it, and you can read it as a kid and get it at a different level. So that's been a very fun project. And actually it's gonna match up with the theater thing, because we're gonna do Snark animation.
Oh, nice.
Everything's coming together.
That's great. So jump in with some of your others, because I mean, yeah, tell me about your other books.
Okay. Well, the ones before that were three paranormal books.
Yeah.
And I've led a paranormal life since I was 4 or 5 years old, when I had my first experience. It was an angelic healing experience in northern Norway. And I was living with my grandmother. My parents and I and my brother were living with my grandmother in northern Norway, 200 miles above the Arctic Circle. And on an isolated island, there's no hospitals or anything. I got really, really sick. So sick that I couldn't move. I couldn't move my head, my limbs. I had a high fever. They thought I was gonna die. And I remember I was lying in this little bed in my grandmother's kitchen, in this old country house kitchen, looking up at the ceiling beams, and I just cried myself to sleep. And when I woke up, there was nobody in the kitchen, but I saw this bright light in the ceiling, and it was warm and it was comforting. And it made me feel like there was nothing to worry about. And it just was this presence. There was no light. Other than, I mean, there wasn't like a physical light there. Mm-hmm. So I went back to sleep. I woke up. When I woke up, my mom and my grandmother were in the kitchen, and I got up and I ran around just like nothing had happened. And they said, "You're feeling great." And I said, "Yeah, I feel fine." And they said, "It's a miracle." And I told them about the light, and they said, "Oh, that was your guardian angel." And so I took that to mean that's real, you know, it's a real thing. So that opened the doors for me for the rest of my life. And I've had paranormal adventures and experiences frequently and randomly throughout my whole life, up to and including, you know, a couple of days ago. So,
dive into the stories a little bit, or how you, did you go directly off of the experiences you had to write the books?
Yes, yeah, they're all my experiences. So the three books, it's called Timeless. Each one is timeless. It's a timeless trilogy. Timeless, Timeless Deja Vu, and Timeless Trinity. And it documents 89 paranormal experiences that I personally have had in my life up to, you know, recently. And everything from the angelic healing thing to the more scarier demonic kind of stuff, to telekinesis, to telepathy, traditional ghost kind of things, you know, physical manifestations of ghosts, and everything in between, and mediumship, all my experiences talking to those who have passed on. So all that stuff was happening. Now, my mother was psychic, so she wasn't a professional psychic, you know, but she was a psychic. And we used to practice reading each other's minds with cards, just playing cards. And my dad was a fisherman and a carpenter and a no-nonsense kind of guy. He was like the deadliest catch guy. He used to fish in Alaska. So he was just Mr. Serious all the time, and a wonderful father, but just, you know, very serious and practical. So he'd let my mom and I read each other's minds, and we'd get a number of hits in a row, way greater than chance. And so she was teaching me. And then after a while, my dad would say, okay, put it away. That's foolishness. That's nonsense. And really what it was, I know now, is that that was the one thing that frightened him. He wasn't afraid of anything else. I mean, he had been a fisherman, worked in big construction jobs. He had been in a Nazi labor camp during World War II, because my parents lived under Nazi occupation in Norway. So he had lived through a lot, and he wasn't afraid of anything except this. He didn't like, you know, telepathy or, you know, any kind of, you know, that kind of stuff. I think that frightened him. I think it really did frighten him. So my mom would listen, we'd listen to my dad, and we put the cards away. My mom would look at me and wink. And I knew that that meant that it was okay to do it, but just, you know, when dad says stop, you have to stop.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's the Timeless series.
Yeah. So that's what I published starting, when Gene came to me, that friend of mine, in October 2016, he told me that I should start telling my stories, because I'd never written about or talked very much about my paranormal experiences other than to some family members and trusted friends. And he said it was time for me to publish these stories. And I told him I was apprehensive because I was afraid I would lose my job. Because when I was hired as a historian, you know, I didn't mention that I talk to dead people and see ghosts and stuff. I mean, it's not something you bring up in a job interview, right? But it's just as important as any other aspect of my life. So I've had to kind of keep it hidden, right? Yeah. So he said, no, don't worry about it. You won't. He said, you have nothing to worry about. And he said, and he's the one who gave me the title. He said, we are timeless. He said, you have nothing to fear. So I took his word for it, and I published them, and it was well received at the college. In fact, they let me teach a paranormal class in the community ed part of the college. So I was really, nobody was more surprised than me. So wow. All these people started coming to me, my fellow faculty, students, and tell me their experiences. Oh, I had a ghost experience, you know, I was safe. I was like a safe harbor for them.
Right.
And there were other people who were skeptical, of course. And I had one former student who's now a professor who said, you realize you've just committed academic suicide, right? And I said, okay. I'm at the end of my career, and I'm not really afraid of what people think, because this is really important. This is a new mission for me. And it's been wonderful. It really has.
That's incredible. I don't know if this is a good time, because a lot of what you're writing and doing kind of overlaps with some of your story.
Yep.
So I'm going to kind of leave that up to you, because you have like some historical things that have been published.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, some, you know, regular what a historian would write about or a political scientist would write about: women's leadership, foreign policy, the Vietnam War. You know, I mean, I enjoyed writing those things, but this was really a departure for me, starting with these timeless books. And
I mean, it's a huge difference.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking at your book list and I'm like, wow, there's not really much of a connection, but there is, because you're the connection and you were the historian first. So yeah, you have six books, historian mm-hmm. type books also. Mm-hmm. And that's far different from Snark, Timeless, the theater you're doing. What about the music?
Well, the music has always been part of my life. I learned the accordion when I was a kid, but then I didn't keep up with it. But I love music. And my mom said she always wanted me to be a musician. You know, my dad said he wanted me to be an engineer. My mom said she wanted me to be a writer, an artist, and a musician. So she was an artist too. She was very psychic. And so I had these two role models, great parents, but very different in their outlooks on life. Very. And so that's kind of, I think that balance has been kind of good for me because, you know, the lady I'm married to, Ginger, is very practical, kind of like my father. She's very practical, very loving and accepting of what I do, but she's not like a true believer. She doesn't go around and talk about the Akashic field and, you know, spirits and, you know, that kind of stuff. So she keeps me grounded. She supports me and she believes me, but she doesn't, you know, it's not like we're a couple of psychics, you know, bouncing ideas off each other all the time. So she's very practical, and she's a helicopter pilot, which is really cool. You know, a female helicopter pilot is very unusual, yeah. Much less a certified flight instructor. I mean, there's very few of those in the world. So, you know, I used to fly in the Army too. When I was in the Army, I was a jail guard first, and then I was a helicopter pilot. So that's kind of how we connected, was through the helicopter.
Well, let's jump back in time now, because there's a lot of Norwegian stuff happening. Jump back. You were born in Seattle. You said you're 62, and your parents lived through the war. They're immigrants then.
Yes. Yeah. I was born in Seattle. My brother and I were born in Seattle, and my sister and my eldest brother were born in Norway during the war, during World War II, during Nazi occupation, because Norway was occupied from 1940 until 1945, so most of the years of World War II. Yeah. And my eldest brother died during the war at age 2 because the Nazis took all the medicine, so he got sick and they had no medicine because the German army took everything that they had. And but my sister lived, and they moved in 1948 to Seattle, where my dad became a fisherman like all the other Norwegians, you know, there. And I was born in 1958. So I grew up with two languages, two cultures. In fact, my first language was Norwegian because that's what was spoken in the home. So when I went to school, that's when I really started speaking English. So now the benefit of that is I'm bilingual, so that's good.
Yeah.
And we still own the home in Norway, and the property, my brother and I. And so I'm very close to Norway all the time. I have what people often call a divided heart. So I have a great deal of love for Norway and a great deal of love for the United States, my country of my birth. So I served, I went to school at 17. I started college, dropped out, joined the military, ended up doing 6 years in the Army. Like I said, a jail guard and then later a helicopter pilot.
That's a little different.
I was a break in service between the two when I was going to engineering school and decided, you know, I'm not an engineer, which was disappointing to my father, but you know, you have to do what you have to do. You know, sometimes you don't know if you're doing it for you or for somebody else. And when you find out it's for somebody else and you're not into it, then you have to be honest about it. So went back in the service. That's when I went to flight school and did my last 3 years as a pilot. And after that, I went to work at Boeing in Seattle, like a lot of people. And I was a contract administrator, business kind of person. That wasn't my thing either. So I kept going to school, and eventually I decided I was going to get my PhD. That's how I ended up in Bowling Green, Ohio.
Yeah.
Getting my doctorate in history, and started teaching in 1991, my own classes. And I've been teaching history ever since then. Started out, you know, part-time teaching after I finished my PhD. And then got my permanent job, my tenure job here at in Southern California in 1998. So, and during that time, I've had 4 children. Now I have 2 grandchildren. And my two eldest boys still live in Ohio.
Okay.
So that's kind of who I am, or where I've been. And during that whole time, I was writing, whether it was history or political science or my own stories or documenting in my journals, the paranormal stuff that I kept hidden until recently.
We're definitely going back into a lot of stuff, but one thing that you say to me, because you brought up Ginger, mm-hmm. Your wife, and you call her the girl of my dreams, mm-hmm. and that just makes my heart happy. So I love that.
She really is. She's a girl of my dreams, the purveyor of my destiny. You know, I didn't really come into who I am until I met her. And that's not to say anything bad about, you know, ex-wives or whatever, but you know, that I did my best and they did their best and we ended up going different ways. But Ginger has provided the structure and has allowed me to really blossom and flourish. And I couldn't ask for a better partner in this life or the next.
Yeah, I feel that way about mine too. So, mm-hmm. And they're not even the same person. So it's great when you find that. Let's mm-hmm. go back into your childhood. I know that there are things that you struggled with. Mm-hmm. And I really, as well as, you know, including military trauma. So let's go back to your childhood and talk about some of the struggles that you've had that I know people are going to relate to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, most people have had struggles, and a lot of people have had traumas as well, which can lead to, you know, certain conditions or disorders or illnesses or whatever. So all that is true with me. And speaking about the paranormal, I in 1964, I had my first encounter with some kind of a non-human intelligence. And it happened to be a very positive experience in that I was saved from there was this family that lived above us in Seattle, on the hill above us, and they would babysit me every once in a while. Excuse me. And they were weird. I'm just going to say it. They were weird. And the man was especially weird. The husband, the father was very weird. And they had three kids, and I would be up there and there'd be other kids in the neighborhood there. And he would do these bizarre things that as a kid, I knew were not right. Now I know what he was a child molester, but at the time I just thought he was acting like a kid. Why is he acting like a kid? He's an adult, he's a dad. He's supposed to act like a dad, you know? Why is he, you know, giving us Dixie cups filled with this weird liquid, you know, that I never drank because I thought there was something, as I know now it was alcohol, but then I didn't know what it was. And, you know, hiding in closets with him in the dark. And I said, I don't want to do any of that. So I was, you know, telling my parents, I don't want to go up there anymore. And they were like, well, you know, because they were friends with him. So they didn't know. My parents didn't know what was going on. And I didn't know how to articulate it, you know. So I had this intervention by this non-human intelligence who actually saved me from that whole thing, told me, don't go up there anymore. I will protect you and tell your parents what that guy is doing. And it was so traumatizing for me to see this, you know, non-human intelligence, an alien, right? That for 2 years I had trouble speaking. So I had a terrible problem with stuttering and stammering, and so bad that they'd have to take me out of class for a couple hours a day when I was in elementary school to go to speech therapy. And it was so bad that I was embarrassed to try to talk, so I just wouldn't talk. And finally I got my confidence back. But if you were to tell me when I was a kid that someday I would be speaking for a living, you know, professor, I would say, no, that's never going to happen. But so it was a terrible experience as a result of something that actually saved me. And I had to work through it. And now the neural pathways that I've created to overcome the stammering and stuttering have actually probably made my brain more nimble and have created the ability to adapt very quickly. Because it's not like it's ever gone away. It's just, it's like the thing is still in my brain that causes me to stammer, but I can make the adjustments so quickly that most people don't even notice, unless you're a speech pathologist where you might, oh, I see a little thing there. But most other people, they wouldn't notice, right? So that was pretty traumatizing.
How did you tell your parents at the time?
I told them I didn't want to go up there anymore because I didn't like them. And my mom got it right away. She knew. I don't think she knew about the non-human intelligence, but she knew how serious I was. And I couldn't articulate that. You know, I just said there's something wrong with that guy. And I think they were starting to kind of think it too. So they said, oh, you don't have to go up there anymore. So I never went up there again.
Good. Okay.
So that was good. So I was never, I was never molested by that person, who's now dead, by the way, in case people are wondering. And I don't know how many other children, who knows, at this point. But as you know, it turns out, at age 11, in between 11 and 12, I was not rescued at that point. And I was, molested as a kid, by a trusted person, in our circle, not the family, but what the Hawaiians would call the ohana, the extended family. And it was very traumatizing. And I carried that with me really until my 30s. I didn't really know what had happened to me until I was arrested. And I was arrested for violent, what they would now call domestic violence. In those days, it was, I don't know what they called it, but anyway. Nobody was more surprised than me. I go, what's going on? I remember when the police arrived and handcuffed me and my two little kids were staring at me. I thought, what's going on? It was like I was asleep before that. And all of a sudden I woke up. I mean, I had, been in the military and done all kinds of things. And I was actually in graduate school and a doctoral program by that time. But still, I didn't know what had happened to me. I knew, but it was so suppressed. So they put me in a program, and it changed my life. And from that point on, it's been a struggle, but dealing with the trauma of it. But I've learned that it's to adopt an injury model rather than an illness model, mm-hmm. for my life. So I know I was injured, but what Hemingway, who said you become stronger in those broken places, you've melded it together, like I did with my brain with the stuttering. So all these things are overcome. You can't go back and erase the negative things, but you can overcome it. As the Marines say, you improvise, adapt, and overcome. And that's how I've approached life. And I did it with this as well. And all those experiences, even though they're negative, including getting divorced 3 times, that's traumatizing. Not traumatizing, but it's horrible. All of those things ultimately have brought me to where I am today and have led me to appreciate Ginger and our life that we have and my children and my grandchildren. So I can't really go back and say that I wish it wouldn't have happened to me, because I wouldn't be who I am if it hadn't happened to me. I wouldn't be writing these books. I wouldn't be helping students work through their trauma, because people come and talk to me. I think they just see that, oh, this guy knows something about it, so I'll come talk to him. And that's, that's part of the mission that I have. I would say that for people who've had those things happen, you need to get, there's no shame in talking to anybody about it. Every Friday, I'm in a VA group, a group of fellow soldiers, because I also had a traumatizing experience in the military that I can talk about in a minute. But every Friday we meet, and it's called DBT. It's Dialectical Behavioral Therapy. And there's a small group, like 5 or 6 of us, who've all been in the military. And we have a very wonderful counselor who's the head of the DBT part of the VA in Long Beach. And we do this all virtually. Now, we did it in person before, but at this point in my life, I don't so much need the therapy, because I'm good, but I'm there to help because I'm the oldest one in the group. I'm there to help the younger guys who are going through what I was going through. So I see it as kind of my new mission, to help them. Even though I'd be fine if I didn't go every Friday, I do it out of a sense of duty to help the counselor in her job in helping the other soldiers that are in the group. So, but yeah, the, I mean, the military, 6 years in the military, terrible things happen. I was never in war, but I did work in a prison and saw, you know, horrible things that people, young people should never see. You know, whether it's combat or working in a prison, the statistics show that prison guards have a higher rate of PTSD than combat veterans. And I think that's because it never lets up. There's never downtime in a prison. There might be a little bit of like, maybe it's not bad at the moment, but at any moment lurking around any corner in any cell is somebody who probably wants to kill you. I never went to work without thinking that somebody was going to kill me or try to kill me. So you have eyes in the back of your head. And, you know, that's a hard way to live as a guard. And when I was in between my two tours of duty, I worked in a maximum security state prison in Minnesota. And that was the worst, the absolute worst. Because I remember one night I was alone in the control room looking at the pictures of all the inmates. And we had 78 inmates in that pod. And on the back was what they're in there for. And out of the 78, over 40 of them were in for at least one murder, many of them multiple murders, plus other stuff. And maximum security prison is where people go who are killing and raping and hurting prisoners in other prisons. So they're the predators among the predators, and they end up there. So I worked there, I think, for 6 months, and then I went back in the Army. So, and then was a helicopter pilot preparing for war. I never went to war, but we got loaded, I think, three or four times on our C-141s, you know, the transports that would take our helicopters and us to a war zone. So we were constantly on alert, and, you know, that was during the Reagan era. And anyway, so all that trauma really impacted me in a very negative way. But ultimately, I've been able to you know, create new neural pathways towards the light, towards health, and towards happiness. And so it's really made me who I am. And it gives me a lot of interesting stories to tell my students, because they always want me to tell my prison stories. Like the first day I'll say, I can tell you some prison stories, you know, and they're thinking, oh, he was an inmate. I said, no, I was on the other side of the bars, but still, you know, I got some stories to tell. And yeah, so that's made me, you know, who I am. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody. Like my youngest son, I don't want him to go into the military. I will do everything I can to keep him out of the military. I'm not anti-military, but, you know, my eldest son is in the military. He's a career Air Force guy. So, but it's just not for everybody. And, you know, I survived, but just barely.
I have a daughter in the Air Force also, and she loves it. It's not for everyone. Can you discuss a little bit more some of the abuse that you went through during those military years? And I want to tie it into that day that you were arrested.
Yeah. Okay. So it started in between when I was first went into the Army, and I joined on Halloween 1978. That's a great day to join the military. And I was in basic training, or it was in January 79. I was graduating from basic training, going into advanced individual training, which is what you do after basic. And I was the drill sergeant, who at that point, he's everything to us. You know, he's taught us everything. You know, we trust this guy, we fear him, everything. He's just a role model, you know, the perfect soldier, right? We emulate this guy. He takes me into his office, and he gets really weird with me. He starts to, like, put his legs between my legs, and he starts, like, holding my neck like he's going to choke me. And then he asked me, are you a homosexual? And I said, no. And he said, oh, okay. And then he took out a knife, and he put it on my neck while he was almost on top of me. And he was, like, scraping. He said, you didn't shave closely enough. And he was, like, rubbing this knife against my neck. And I just was frozen, right? What am I going to do? Who's going to believe me, right? And it was weirdly threatening and sexual at the same time. It was this weird power sexual thing he was doing. So I didn't tell anybody. And but up to that point, I really enjoyed being in the Army. I really dug it. You know, I was getting physically fit, and I believed in the whole thing. From that point on, I went to my duty station. Well, I didn't even make it onto the transport plane to go to Germany where I was supposed to be stationed. I went AWOL because I was so mixed up. You know, what am I going to do? There's going to be other guys like him when I end up in Germany, and then my parents aren't here, just like they weren't in Alabama when it happened. So I was feeling very frightened. And luckily, I was not prosecuted for AWOL because a chaplain stepped in and helped me and said, "I understand, son, I'll get you on the plane, and this I'll erase all this that happened, and you can start over." So he was a wonderful man, you know. So ended up going to Germany. When I got to Germany, I got to the prison, and I the first night in the barracks, somebody stole all my money, and well, almost all of it. I had some traveler's checks left, and I decided I was going to go AWOL again. So I did. And I was gone for like 5 days. And because I just got to the unit, nobody knew. I wasn't even officially checked in. So when my aunt in Norway convinced me to come back to Germany, they didn't even know I was gone. That's how little they cared or whatever. So I didn't happen to mention I'd been AWOL for 5 days. So I just, you know, blended right back in. And yeah, so working in the prison, we were threatened constantly. And one time I know this is an adult themed show, so I can talk
yes,
about it.
Yes, it is. Yes.
I saw two prisoners who were, well, one prisoner was raping another prisoner. And mind you, I'm 20 years old, and I was a very, you know, protected, you know, I mean, I had great parents and everything, except for what happened to me when I was 11. But, and I saw this, and I told these guys to, you know, I told the guy to stop, and I was going to write him up. And he told me he was going to kill me. No, he said, "First, I'm going to rape you, and then I'm going to kill you." And I figured he was serious. And he was an older, like a sergeant in the, you know, that he was an older guy. Well, he's probably only 25, but I was 20. So that seems a lot older when you're 20. So I wrote him up, and he got some extra prison time as a result. And he told other prisoners, you know, about that. So there was this rumor going around that they were going to find me, capture me, and kill me, you know. So I, for months after that, I was living in fear of that. And so, you know, working in a prison is a horrible place to be for especially a sensitive person, really an artistic person, you know, which is what I am. So I had to constantly protect myself. I used to create what I called a bubble around me just so I can make it through the day. And then in the maximum security prison, it was a horrible place as well. And the last day I worked there, there was a fire in the segregation unit, which is the worst of the worst of the worst in the prison. Mm-hmm. And somebody lit their mattress on fire, and the ventilation fan, because it was a new prison at the time, wasn't working. So the unit filled with black smoke. We had to go in, pop all the cells open, and grab the prisoners who were unconscious and bring them out. We didn't have gas masks or anything. And a lot of us got sick. You know, I was coughing up black stuff out of my lungs for weeks after that. And a friend of mine who rescued one of the prisoners, the prisoner woke up and started to beat him up. You know, the guard had just saved his life, and the guy started trying to kill him, you know. And I thought, that was my last night working in a prison. I said, that's it. This is not worth it to me for my health, my well-being. You know, here you are rescuing people, saving their lives, and they're murderers to begin with, right? So it's not like they're the most upstanding citizens. And what thanks do you get? They try to kill you even though you just saved their life. So I got so disenchanted with the whole thing. I quit after that night. And so those are the experiences that kind of collected and I kept hidden. And it came out in very bizarre ways. I would have this, everything is fine. And then I would have this explosive temper at any little infraction, you know, I could just flip out and not just be violent, but like scary violent. And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3", 250, 260. And I scared a lot of people. Although most of the time I was calm because I didn't know how to let my emotions out, because I was taught in the army, in the prison, actually my whole life, you know, you can't, that's the way we used to condition little boys. You know, you can't cry, you can't show emotion. All you can show is anger or nothing. Don't show anything. So it just exploded. And I had a very abusive relationship with my first wife, who was also in the army. And I didn't even know what was going on. And until, like I said, I remember that day when I got arrested, we had a big argument. I took the kitchen table and I picked it up and threw it against the wall with all the dishes on it and everything. It was a horrible display of anger and violence. And I wasn't attacking her. I was just, I didn't know what to do with all my emotions. So next thing I know, she calls the cops, and I said, the cops arrived. And I said, what did you do? She said, I called the police. This is over. I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And of course she was right. She probably should have called the cops a lot earlier than that, but you know, I don't blame her for doing that. And the next thing I know, I'm being taken away in handcuffs. And that's when I had to figure out how to deal with my emotions in a constructive way and not in a destructive way.
So, is that when you found the VA group?
I was just going to the county, because the county gave me a choice. Either you go to jail or you go to the domestic violence program. So it was run by the county, there, Wood County in Bowling Green. And so I went through that program, and it really set me on a course that changed my life. And I was able to start getting counseling, and I've been in counseling ever since. That was in 1991. So I've been in counseling since then, maintaining, you know.
Yeah.
And it was life-changing. And the key to the whole thing is realizing the responsibility you have to take for yourself. And I every semester, and some of the students get a little squirmy when I talk about it, but I talk about domestic violence every semester. And sometimes I'll tell them that I was arrested. Sometimes I won't. Depends on how I feel. But right. If I feel like this group is going to want me to connect them to it. But I tell the story, nevertheless. And I tell them about domestic violence, and I tell them that it's really important for you to report it right away. And because the longer it goes on, the more it gets set in. And I said, I tell them, because this, you never hear anybody say this. And I say, if you are the perpetrator, like I was, if you are the perpetrator, realize that you're not a bad person. You've just made bad decisions. Now is the time to make good decisions. And that's what a lot of guys do. A lot of the guys I guarded in prison, they tell me, oh, you don't understand. I was, you know, beat up and molested as a kid and lived in this violent, crime-ridden neighborhood and had to join a gang. I said, I feel really sorry for you that you didn't have a kind and gentle and loving environment as a kid. But there are a lot of people who did, who had what you had, that horrible childhood, and did not murder somebody, did not rape somebody, did not commit armed robbery, you know. And they go, yeah, you're right, you know. And I said, so yeah, I feel bad that you had those experiences, but now you can make the decision not to make those bad choices.
Right.
And there's, you're a good person inside. You've just made terrible decisions. And that was a startling realization, that you didn't have to live in shame of what you've done. Because if you start going down that path, like, I'm no good, you know, I'm terrible, I'm, you know, I'm a violent person, I'm this, I'm that, well, then you never get out of that rut. You got to say, no, I'm not that, and be who you want to be. And that's what I tell the students. And it's funny, I get, you know, you've probably seen ratemyprofessor.com. It's this, okay. This thing they do. It's unofficial. It's all driven by students. But awesome. A number of times I've seen students say, I like his class, but when he starts talking about domestic violence, I think I get really uncomfortable, you know. And I try to tell them, I said, you're not learning unless you're uncomfortable. Because if you're just learning stuff you already know and feel comfortable with, you're not being challenged. So
right.
It's good to challenge them emotionally, psychologically, and you know, intellectually. You got to challenge them. I mean, that's how they grow. So Anyway.
When did you get diagnosed with PTSD? I know you eventually found the group with the VA that's made mm-hmm. a big difference. And was there ever a diagnosis? And then we're segueing that. You've gotten your degree. You've become mm-hmm. a professor in all of this happening. And then, you know, you had the childhood friend come to you in 2016. So mm-hmm. you found the VA group, or the VA group found you, and that made a huge impact. And then was there a diagnosis of PTSD?
Yes, the first diagnosis that I had, official diagnosis that was in my medical record. Well, it started when I got arrested and I went through counseling. That's when I first realized I probably have PTSD. But there's no medical records of it until 2001, when it was finally entered into my medical records that I have a copy of it. And I was put on medication for the first time, which helped me tremendously, kept going to counseling. But during that time, I was building a veterans program at Citrus, where I work, and started a Boots to Books transition course for veterans. And I was helping all these veterans. And then finally, one day, I think it was in 2000, when was it? It was about 7 years ago. A veteran student came up to me and said, "Dr. Solheim, you know, I really appreciate what you've done for us, but shouldn't you help yourself?" And he knew that I had PTSD. He didn't have to ask me if I had PTSD. He knew, because veterans know, you know, they know each other. And I thought about it, and I thought, I've never really dealt with it myself. And he said, you're helping us get help from the VA. Maybe you should ask for help. So that was an eye-opener for me when one of my veteran students told me I should go to the VA. So that's when I did. And then I've been involved with counseling at the VA ever since. And I'm really glad that I was able to do that. And I had progressed a lot on my own and through civilian counseling, but the VA has been extremely helpful for me, because it spoke to me in a way that civilian counselors, it's not that they don't understand, it's just there's that special connection you have when you're talking to people that have had very similar experiences to yours.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to explain what military humor is, you know, and how it can be so dark and horrible, but yet it makes sense to people who've been in that situation. So yeah, so that's how that connected.
I love seeing the connections, and I'm glad that you took your own advice and got
finally,
help.
Help yourself.
Yeah, and I'm super glad that the VA helped. Those are stories I think we need to hear more mm-hmm. of, because there's certainly the opposite. Mm-hmm. So you've gone through all this. You become a professor. You are working on yourself constantly in several different ways. How much did it help you? In our last time together, in this last 10 minutes, I'd like to talk about how much that helped you become a writer. And I know that the visit from your friend gave you basically the guts to just put it mm-hmm. out there, even though as a professor, maybe not. Mm-hmm. And how much does history play into paranormal?
Well, yeah. So there's some big questions there.
I know. I'm sorry.
To round us out here. let's start with the history part. All of it, the way I teach history is that all history begins and ends with the individual. That's what I teach my students. So what is history? It's what we do. It's the record of what we have done as individuals. Collectively then becomes our nation's history or our world history, right? So each one of us plays a role. Each one of us has a role to play. And what we do or don't do makes a difference, especially when you put it together. I give the example of, like, in a military example, America doesn't go to war. Individual Americans go to war. And then they come home with the issues they have, and they impact their families, their communities, their country. So we've ended up as a nation, this is where it all ties together. As a nation, we're a warrior nation. And people ask me all the time, What can we do about gun violence? What can we do about violence in America? It seems like there's shootings, you know, we're coming out of the pandemic. Now all of a sudden the mass shooters are coming back. And I said, because it doesn't have anything to do with guns. I mean, it has something to do with guns, but that's not the main issue. The main issue is cultural. It's social. We are a warrior culture. We've been at war since the beginning, and we've never not been at war. So we never heal from one war before we're in another one. And in many ways, the Wild West paradigm is what we have. You know, we have never really progressed from that Wild West time, you know, type of situation. Because you look at other countries that have per capita many more guns than we have. Right. And I'm not to say we shouldn't have, you know, reasonable gun control and all that. I agree with that. But we got to work on ourselves as collectively as a nation and heal ourselves from these wars. And because it's secondhand smoke effect, you know, when a warrior comes back, it affects their whole community. It affects their family. And they don't do it on purpose, of course, but it just perpetuates the cycle of violence and the cycle of war. And you can actually wean yourself off of that, but it's a lengthy process. And there are no politicians who want to say, I'm going to end gun violence by starting a social cultural program that'll last probably a generation before we see the first results.
Right.
Now you got to get elected in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, whatever it is. And you can't offer some long-term solution like that. So we offer these quick things that seem to be a band-aid on a gaping wound, and it just keeps going on. So that's how history figures into our culture of violence. And in terms of history and the paranormal, I mean, really the spirit, if you go back to the Fox sisters in the 1840s, they were the first ones who heard this rapping in the walls. And then it started this whole spiritualism craze that spread around the world. And then mediums and, you know, spirit mediums, physical mediums started appearing, no pun intended. And so that kind of mixed together with the abolition movement and with the women's movement all together. And it was kind of interesting in our history how those things all came together. But at one point, most major newspapers promoted spiritualism, you know, this idea of talking to spirits, if you can believe that. I mean, every once in a while, you'll see a story in the LA Times or the New York Times or whatever. But I mean, this was a constant thing. They were talking about apparitions and what we now call cryptids and things. I mean, it was just a very normal part of, you know, how they presented the news, and people talked about it. And so it's interesting how the paranormal's been with us for quite a while. And of course, before that, back in ancient times, it's been carried through, you know, from the oracles of ancient Greece and mm-hmm. and you know, the Native Americans and their shamanism, you know, whatever. I mean, it's a long tradition. So it's really, that's why I say the paranormal is not really, it's normal. And the supernatural is really natural. That's what I've come to believe. And now I forgot the other part of the thing I was supposed to talk about.
Oh my gosh. Well, let's see. We're good. We're told we can do whatever we want, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
How did it connect? How healing was it for you to start writing? I know you wrote a lot of history stuff. I know that history stuff is probably pretty natural for you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how cathartic it is or not. But as far as the personal writing that you've done, mm-hmm. How much did that help in your healing journey?
Well, everything I've written, no matter if it was a history book, political science book, a play, a comic book, whatever it was, a novel, I wrote a novel for children. I was always compelled to do it because of some problem or some issue. When I wrote the women's leadership books, it was because my mom had just died. Mm. And I realized how important she was in the family. And I kind of, I feel bad that I didn't really recognize that, although she's forgiven me, I know that, but I really came to realize that. So I was compelled to write women's leadership books to understand how women in leadership, what they bring to that role, right. And whether it's political leadership or whatever. And the Vietnam War book that I wrote was because my brother's a Vietnam War veteran. And I saw how he suffered and how his generation of veterans suffered when they came back and were treated very, very badly. And, you know, I started teaching a Vietnam War class. And I decided to write the book because of what I saw that happened to my brother. And then we already talked about the paranormal books. And the first book I wrote, which was my doctoral dissertation, was about the Scandinavian area during the Cold War. and how they survived, wedged between the Soviet Union and the United States, the two superpowers trying to vie for control of the high north, which is going on right as we speak right now. There's a lot of stuff that a lot of Americans don't know about going on in Norway in particular. Very scary stuff, but anyway. So that I wrote it because of my connection to Norway. So everything I've done, I've been compelled to research and write and find out answers about. My first play was based on my friend, a Vietnam vet who committed suicide. I felt so bad about it, and I couldn't figure out how am I gonna tell his story? Mm. Am I gonna write a history article, a book? And then it came to me, this has gotta be a play. So I started imagining what the play would look like. Only problem is I'd never written a play at that point. So I have to
semantics, right?
Yeah, you know. So I had to go figure out how to do that. Steep learning curve, but we ended up getting it produced, and we even won. I say we because it takes a village to create a play. We got two awards from the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival in 2013. So we won two awards, and then my second play was also produced, and that was about the Nazi occupation of Norway. So everything I've written, it is very cathartic. You're right. I mean, it's always, okay. I'm driven to do it. It's not like I sit down and say, I'm going to write a novel. What should I write about? It just, I'm forced to do it. And right. I mean, I love doing it, but I'm compelled to do it. It's like, I don't have a choice. I'm driven to do it.
That's a beautiful thing though. I would think there's a lot of healing that comes through that journey.
Yes. Yes. There has to be, because, you know, all of us suffer. And we learn, you know, what life means because of that suffering. I don't want to sound like a Zen Buddhist or something, but it actually that's very true. It's through that suffering and that search for meaning that we figure out, you know, what the world is about and what our role is in that. And I always tell my students, you know, you have to go on. If you haven't started your journey of figuring out who you are and why you're here, you're going to start today. Mm-hmm. And I, even though they're young and they have a long ways to go, I said, the sooner you start that journey, the better off you'll be. And a lot of them say, oh, I don't know. What do you mean who I am? My name's Joe or whatever. And I said, no, who are you really? And why are you here? Well, I'm here to get credits. No, that's not it. Why are you here on this earth? You know, what is your purpose? What is, so they start, I give them those kind of existential questions to challenge them. I challenge them in every way that I can. So when, you know, this whole idea of that we're supposed to provide comfort zones for students, I understand that. I mean, they shouldn't be called names and, you know, ridiculed and stuff. But in every other way, I want to challenge them. I don't want them to be comfortable. If they come to my class and they say, wow, I'm just going to sit back and she's just going to tell me what I already know, you know, that's nothing. That's no good. Wasting my time, wasting their time. So.
Agreed. Thank you so much for being on today and for sharing. Thank you. I really appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Jen. I appreciate it.